Tonight on The Download, mystery novelist Steve Hamilton. From the Second City show, The Art of Falling, Tim Mason and Carissa Bereka. And live music from Max the Fox. And now here's your host, a man who just discovered the Billy Ocean channel on Pandora, Justin Kaufman.
I officially have a summer jam. It was in Whole Foods this morning, and I heard it, and I just I automatically started singing along. Like, I didn't even think about it. It's like, when the going gets tough, the tough gets going. When the going gets tough, the tough gets going, yeah. I think it was, like, from a movie. Ooh, I want to touch ya. I can't remember what movie it was from. It was a soundtrack song. Billy Ocean. Get out of my car into your dreams, into my dreams.
Yeah.
Which seems weird. Creepy. A little creepy. But yeah, I heard it. I was like, you know what, man? Billy Ocean. Maybe they should get Billy Ocean on the show. I'd be down with that. Like a big table with Billy Ocean.
Right.
Oh, man, so good.
I'll work on it.
Welcome to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. I hope you had a great weekend. I hope your Monday was sufficient. We are back here on Monday night, jazzed, ready, amped to give you some good show. And it starts at 7:30 as we have, it's back, we're back. Dave Lundy and Chris Roebling, touche! The boys will be back in studio after 7:30 to discuss who's imploding, Trump or Hillary. That's it. I'll throw that one question out, and I'll let these guys, Dave Lundy, a Democrat analyst, Chris Roebling, a Republican analyst, just let them just start arguing, like talking. We wanted to call this talking over each other instead of touche, but it was too many. It's too long of a hashtag. Coming up at 8 o'clock, my guest at the big table, Steve Hamilton, New York Times bestselling author, The Second Life of Nick Mason. He's created a new character, Nick Mason. I'm excited to talk to Steve about essentially what goes into creating a new character. Mystery novels are always around a character, even Jason Bourne style, you know. Here, V.I. Warshawski, that's really been made famous here in Chicago. But, you know, it'd be interesting to talk because this is a character, Nick Mason, that is the beginning of a series. And frankly, it's set here in Chicago. And Steve Hamilton, who's not from here, came to Chicago. Sat in, shadowed a detective, learned all about the neighborhoods he possibly could, interviewed people to be able to do a novel about this town. Did he get it right? Talk with Steve Hamilton coming up at the big table. In the 9 o'clock hour tonight, dance, comedy, and vaudeville. It's pretty simple, right? Dance and comedy are intersect at the new Hubbard Street Second City show, Art of Falling. It's actually a remount. They're doing it again. After a much successful run last year, I think it was last year, being able to put Second City comedy together with Hubbard Street dance, it's perfect. Also, we're going to talk Thaddeus and Slocum, a vaudeville adventure with playwright Kevin Douglas, the new Looking Glass show, Thaddeus and Slocum. I know Kevin. I've known Kevin for a long time. He and I did a show at Steppenwolf together. I know. You don't take me for a Steppenwolf actor.
Ah,
yeah.
Tell me about it.
The big lights, big stage. It was called Crossroads. I forgot it was like a series they were doing on once a month. And they were taking, like musicians. And they took Schadenfreude and his group, Kevinda, who was Kevin and Inda. And we did a sketch show, but it was, they were an African-American duo. And I guess we were white. And it was a show about race.
Nice.
Yeah. It was very fun to work with Kevin. He's a huge talent. And he went to the Aspen Comedy Festival, and he stayed in Chicago to become a ensemble member at Looking Glass. And now he's writing plays. His show Thaddeus and Slocum just opened, and it's going to be running through June. So we'll have Kevin in here. I haven't seen Kevin in a while. Saw him on the street about maybe like 8 months ago. Just walked by like, hey, gotta go. So it'll be great to see him, him in studio here for his show. And then coming up at 10 o'clock, I'm excited about this. Max the Fox, the indie folk pop quintet, will be in studio performing live. We decided to move the worst out of Mondays. That's on Tuesday nights now, so we could have a little bit more time for the live music in studio. It's such a, I mean, it's a spectacle. If you turn on the web camera, you know, the stream, to be able to look the visuals, the band takes over the studio, mm-hmm. the drum set, the keys, the, in this case, we get a cello and a, is it viola or viola?
Viola?
Viola. Not a violin, a viola. All sorts of stuff that's going to be happening with Max the Fox. And we decided that we wanted to spend more time, give it more like a sessions feel. So we're coming up with a name. Pete mm-hmm. and I spent a good chunk today, about 30 minutes going, sitting in the studio going, I don't know, mix? What if engine equipment? What if we did some Michigan Avenue mix minus master sessions? And we haven't figured it out yet. We're kind of close on, and you can help us out here, 312-981-7200. You can text in. We're close on Backstage 435, because mm-hmm. this is 435 North Michigan. And then another one that might just be more generic, the set list. I like the set list. That's generic, and it doesn't seem to be, but that might be one that's just so low-hanging fruit, if you will. So we'll have that. So tonight, if you have an idea for what we should name our sessions at 10 o'clock on Mondays, let's do it. I'll give you pizza. News, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman. This here is The Download, show about Chicago starring those who know it well. We'll take a break. We'll come back. Give you the carryout. Stay with us. Our texter 815 just texted in and said, The Going Gets Tough by Billy Ocean's from Romancing the Stone. So there you go. On movie, you know what? My summer movie jam. Got Billy Ocean on the music side, Romancing the Stone on the movie side. Looking good. Just need a TV show now. All right, here's the carryout, our nightly look at the news. Of course, this is where I read the newspaper, so you at home, you don't have to. Here are today's top stories. Governor Rauner told reporters that the biggest disappointment in office has been watching Mayor Emanuel fail to stand up to Mike Madigan. Really? The governor understands that the mayor of Chicago and the Speaker of the House are Democrats, right? It's interesting strategy by Rauner, first with Cullerton saying that Cullerton was on board with all the pension changes, and now with the mayor, as if there was some sort of expectation that the mayor would turn on Springfield Democrats. Emanuel responded by calling Rauner baby Trump again, and that he sounds just like a VP candidate. Oh, interesting. Trump Rauner? I like the sound of that. Rauner then went on to say that CPS schools are like crumbling prisons. He knows kids go to those schools, right? As a leader, you may not want to call your state schools prisons. Trump Rauner, I'm loving it more and more and more. Also, the state of Illinois employers warned of over 1,300 layoffs in the month of May. That's a lot of warnings. Also, maybe that should be the biggest disappointment of your 18 months in office, Governor. Just a thought. Trump Rauner. Donald Trump had a tough weekend after attacking a judge in a case against Trump University. The judge has Mexican heritage, and Trump suggested that he couldn't be impartial because of Trump's desire to build a wall. He then went on to say the same thing about any judges with Muslim backgrounds. So if Donald Trump becomes president, it's going to be an Anglo-Saxon white male renaissance. Finally. Tomorrow's the primary for the state of California, really the final stop for this campaign train, which is really more of a crowded old commuter train that's never on time than a bullet train. This is going to be interesting. If Senator Bernie Sanders beats Secretary Hillary Clinton in California, it may not matter because she'll have the delegates to win the nomination. But come on, talk about limping across the finish line. When called for comment, Bernie Sanders was like, hello? Hello? Who's on the line? Who's there? I had to do it. This could be the last time. No charges were filed against the mother of a three-year-old who got into the gorilla cage at the Cincinnati Zoo. Good. I say let the parents go, but the three-year-old, working camp till he's 25. Unless, of course, he's a Stanford swimmer who gets caught raping an unconscious woman behind a dumpster. Then 6 months. Thousands of bees swarmed a locked bike in downtown Chicago today. I guess the queen came down, set up shop on the bike, and the worker bees followed. The rumor is that they got priced out of Logan Square and they're just looking for affordable housing, hence the bike. Update, the bees are gone. They moved because the bike didn't have central air. Not close to the L. In weather, summer. In sports, the Cubs lost yesterday, but who cares? Arrieta had 12 Ks, and at one point, 10 of his first 11 outs were strikeouts.
But he got his first loss of the year. The Cubs put on their track jackets, and they're taking on the upstart Phillies in Philadelphia tonight. It's a 9-game road trip. And the Sox get the day off to reflect and absorb all the calls to fire manager Robin Ventura. The Sox needed to take the series against the Tigers, but instead continued their uninspiring free fall by getting swept. The Tigers are now a half game back of the third place Chicago White Sox. And it doesn't get easier. The Washington Nationals come to town tomorrow. The Sox did make a move to acquire starting pitching. James Shields came over from the Padres to ultimately fill the John Danks spot in the rotation. Shields was just awful in San Diego, and the owner called him an embarrassment after his failed year plus there. So things are looking up, Sox fans. He starts tomorrow night. The Golden State Warriors beat the Cleveland Cavaliers by 33 points yesterday to take a 2-0 lead in the NBA Finals. 33-point win in an NBA Final. Yeah, okay. The Cavs could have done that without LeBron. Just saying. Could have stayed in Miami. Rumors are circulating that Tom Thibodeau and the Minnesota Timberwolves have made Joakim Noah a high free agent target this summer. Mark my words, the Timberwolves will get to the NBA Finals before the Bulls do. I'm on the record. I'm on the record. In Bears football, the 2016 guys are signed. Jonathan Bullard from Florida signed today. Remember that name. I have a big feeling that he's going to be a star. More Alex Brown than Alonzo Spellman. More Trace Armstrong, less Philip Daniels. More Adewale Ogunleye, less Adewale Ogunleye. And finally, the Lincoln Park Zoo named a new baby camel, Alexander Camelton. Welcome to Chicago, Alexander. And when you escape and trample Chicagoans with unmitigated pent-up rage from the other animals teasing you for your stupid name, we'll remember you fondly. Alexander Camelton. That's the carryout for June 6, 2016. Hey, we put your food in a greasy paper bag, you know, for authenticity.
More to come tonight. Chris Roebling and Dave Lundy here in studio arguing about Trump. It's going to be great. It's another episode of Touche coming up here after the news. It's a download on 720 WGN. Stay with us.
I just said that.
I know you just said that.
Okay, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
Well, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
That's what I just said.
That's what I'm saying to you.
All right.
It's time for Touche here on the download on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, this is our month. This is our Monday. I guess this is Monday. Evening quarterbacking for the 2016 campaign. We've been doing it every Monday. We continue to do it with Dave Lundy and Chris Roebling. Dave Lundy, a Democrat analyst. Chris Roebling, a Republican analyst. Who's imploding more, Hillary or Trump? Go.
Obviously, clearly, Hillary, Trump is imploding.
Hillary is
Trump
imploding.
Trump is just absolutely losing his mind.
That she...
See, I was waiting all day for that, guys. I was waiting all day. All right. We do have breaking news tonight. Big news. Hillary Clinton has enough delegates to become the Democrat nominee for president. Dave, how is that possible a day before California?
This is according to the Associated Press. They just posted this about 10 minutes ago.
You mean her super PAC?
AP is her super PAC now, yes. And Fox News is her communications arm. The AP reported this, and my guess is, and I was kind of thinking this might happen, remember, Trump clinched, not when an election happened, but when some of the unaffiliated delegates were called by reporters and were asked, who do you support? And they said, oh, we support Donald Trump. I suspect the exact same thing happened. There were about 110 superdelegates that hadn't committed yet. And I suspect today, so she picked up, she had two wins over the weekend in the Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico.
Wow.
Huge.
That's huge.
Huge.
Wow. VI.
Hey,
has Bill been there?
I love the Virgin Islands. And so those helped close the gap. And
the
so she was only
Virgin Islands.
She was only down by 19. And so I'm sure that they called around and they got out that she had 2383. So
you know,
Hillary
so
is the nominee.
All right. How many times? Okay, so let's just review the bidding. They don't run a Democratic primary on it for the Democratic Party. And they've got this crazy institution of the superdelegates, which is way out of control. And these people are susceptible. And I'll tell you, I think there is every chance in the world that Hillary will not be the nominee of the Democratic Party. Because the FBI, FBI.
I walked right into it.
You walked right into it, Justin.
I am telling you, the FBI does not spend this
much time in July, Chris is still going to be saying this. She's going to be giving the speech at the convention saying, thank you, I accept your nomination. And Chris is going to say, I will bet she's not going to be the nominee.
No. By then, I will say I was wrong. But up until then, I am saying that this woman is not yet the nominee.
Let's stay on Hillary and Bernie. Yeah. And what does this mean? I mean, obviously, clinching the nominee means everything. But tomorrow in California, I mean, they put so much for the voters there. There's been so much made of Bernie putting all of his marbles into California and everything. And it's over? It doesn't mean anything?
Well, it's not that it doesn't mean anything. Obviously, well, first of all, there's several contests tomorrow. In New Jersey, she's going to clean up. She's going to win huge, probably.
Yeah, but all eyes are in California.
Well, all eyes are in California, but New Jersey's got 180 delegates.
It's big.
And there are several other states, and obviously California is, as Bernie said, the big enchilada. Donald Trump would have said that, but then he would have, you know, been attacking the enchilada for not being an American.
What?
Anyway.
What is he saying?
I think everybody in our audience knows what I'm saying, Chris.
So
California, you know, sure, it matters. It would be nice, but it's all gravy. In terms of what deciding the nomination's been decided. Our nominee is Hillary Clinton.
No, the nomination has not been decided. And no, your nominee is not yet anybody. So let's just correct that record. Number two is it does mean a heck of a lot out there because, you know, she's had a hell of a time putting this guy away. She was supposed to be a great candidate by now. She was supposed to have learned from 2008. She's not a particularly good candidate. She's got her weaknesses. And I'll tell you, Trump, for all of his foibles, and he certainly, you know, David is chomping at the bit to get onto Trump foibles. But you know what? Trump is still doing very well out there. And I think that Hillary is not at all assured of winning in November. And
you can make the argument that one of Hillary's strengths right now is Donald Trump, because it seems like more, I don't know what's happened, but it seems like every day a news story comes out that's foot in mouth. But is it affecting him, Chris? And we'll go over we'll get to the foibles, Dave. But is it affecting him? I mean, Republican leaders on the establishment are coming out saying, "Ooh, no, we don't want anything to do with this judge. We don't want anything to do with this."
Right. There's a lot of hypocrisy about the judge thing. But I will tell you that I did not support Trump in the primary. I urge people not to vote for him. He prevailed in the primaries, and it's indicated that he's got more than enough delegates than he needs to get the nomination. That's the way you're supposed to say it, David. That's where Trump is. Is Trump going to get the nomination? No one knows if Trump is going to actually get the nomination. Right now, he is the presumptive nominee, okay? Mm-hmm. And if he keeps makes dumb own goal errors, like, you know, impugning this guy's Americanism because of his family lineage, okay, he might not be the nominee. And I personally would not shed a very big tear about that. Actually, David would be the one shedding the tear about that.
But now it's so interesting, though, on the other side. And today there's an article about how the Trump surrogates are being told by Trump, hey, press this, keep pushing this, do not move away from the idea of this judge is being unfair. It seems strangely political when it shouldn't be.
Well, it's worse than that. This story that came out today about a conference call between Trump himself and his surrogates, in which he told his surrogates not only don't back down on the judge issue, he called on his surrogates to attack the judge's integrity, and he then called upon his surrogates to attack the media as racist for identifying this issue. I mean, this guy is seriously going off the rails, and frankly, the wheels are falling off the bus way earlier than I expected.
Dave, I hear you. I hear you loud and clear, because every morning it becomes entertainment. But you know, the wheels falling off. I mean, I feel like I've heard you say that and other Democrats say that for the last 3 months, and they're not falling off.
No, they're not falling off. And in fact, Trump is remaining, at the very least, very close to Hillary, or in some cases ahead of Hillary in the general polls. Now, it's way too early for those to have a lot of predictive value, but I think many of them, especially the ones that are well done, have current descriptive value. And they're describing a country that understands who and what Hillary is, all personalities aside, who she is, what she represents, you know, a third term of Obama, or you put it in the nicest terms, flowery mm-hmm. terms that you want. That's who she is. Trump is basically cast in the role of not that. OK, not that. And when he does things like this phone call this afternoon with the surrogates, he is emphatically not that.
Right.
And that is what Trump has ridden through 17 opponents in the Republican primary, and he's riding it for the last month and a half against Hillary, and he is even or ahead of Hillary.
But right. Here's the thing. First of all, you misunderstand the rules of your own party. Trump is the nominee. He has enough pledged delegates, and the pledged delegates are obligated on the first ballot to vote for Trump.
Okay.
So Trump is the nominee. Second of all, I think that the idea that Trump is going to be able to win by simply being not Hillary, it's just not credible. And she started last week. She finally did something that just excited her supporters, which was
she told the truth.
Yes, she did. And what she said was that Donald Trump is unfit Finally. Temperamentally and in every other way to be president. And all she did was quote him.
Right.
I mean, she dissected him in a way that
I would say a lot of Americans are waiting for.
Right.
Because we want to know whether or not this is a show, a sham, a piece of entertainment, if this is just a not Hillary campaign. So for her to jump out and actually start to attack Donald Trump with his own words, it's, I think, something we've been waiting for.
Yeah, this is missing the point. This is Hillary and David and the establishment and the mainstream media and the AP super PAC and the mainstream media super PAC.
all of which I control.
You're all misunderstanding, I think, the worldview of the voters. And there, she is speaking to the choir with that. She is speaking to the converted. She is speaking to the folks who are going to vote for Hillary. The folks who are out there making decisions, what you're seeing and what is of greatest significance to Hillary's viability and what is of greatest significance to Trump's viability, there are a lot of Obama voters who are not motivated to come out. And there are a lot of Obama voters who are not voting for Hillary. And there are a lot of Obama voters who are going to vote for Trump. So we're into microscopic elements of the overall popular vote. But they're very significant in and of themselves, and especially at the state level. This is why I don't back down from the idea that Trump is going to win an extraordinary number of states, and he's going to do it because people are so upset with the 38,000 paltry jobs that were created last month in the non-existent recovery of Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton.
And if you had a normal candidate, a decent candidate, he might have pressed that issue for days on end. But he didn't. Instead, what he pressed is a racist attack against an honorable Hoosier. Judge Curiel is a Hoosier. He's not a Mexican, as Judge just said.
No, we're going to go through.
We're going to go through? Okay. Yeah. Here is, you know, it is the hypocrisy here. Let me just, two realms of hypocrisy. The Democrats have told us for 1,000 years that it is not enough to be a smart lawyer to be a good federal judge. You have to represent some element of society. You've got to, and so the ultimate expression of that came from the self-regarding Sonia Sotomayor when she said, you know, I think a wise Latina on the Supreme Court will be able to give a ruling that makes sense to people, somebody about something on some issue. OK, whatever the heck she was trying to say,
yeah,
God
it's not
only
really
knows
what she said.
What that was abject racism. And it was denounced at the time by conservatives. And then you get Barack Obama wheedling the United States Supreme Court on national TV. And these guys are acting once again with, you know,
all of these guys are subject to criticism. Sotomayor's remarks or President Obama's remarks are in the same ballpark to what Donald Trump said. Maybe he needs to then get a speechwriter. Because at least there was some nuance in what the words that President Obama
said. I already said Trump should not be questioning the family lineage of, you know, Judge X or Judge Y or Judge Z. But these guys are trying to say that judges are somehow sacrosanct
when
they spent all this time beating up on the judges. They beat up on the judges for Citizens United.
Not because of his race.
No, we're trying to say the judges.
They have beaten up on Clarence Thomas because of his race since the day he was nominated, Justin.
Chris. the reason that they are beating up, the reason that what Trump is doing is being attacked universally by Republicans. Newt Gingrich called it a catastrophic mistake today. Okay, Republican after Republican after Republican have said this is wrong. It's racist. Ben Sasse says it's racist. This is totally different.
What Trump said,
What Trump said this weekend was that it is he cannot be judged fairly by a judge who is Latino or a judge who is Muslim. We haven't gone down the list of all the other people who can't judge.
That might be true.
And if you
are you telling me that that's not true?
Yes, I'm telling you it's not true.
Well, and if you take Trump, how can you say
that
that's not
true? If we take this to its logical extension, then what? A white person can only judge a white person. A black person can only judge a black person.
No, that's not a logical extension.
This is insane. This is attacking the judiciary.
You're making a philosophical error, my friend. That is not the logical extension. The logical extension is, can Trump, given his stated positions, get justice in America? And half of the Democratic Party is devoted 27 hours a day to saying that there are all kinds of categories of people out there who cannot get justice in America. So Donald Trump stands up and says, look, I've been saying a lot of things about Islam. I've been saying a lot of things about Muslims. I've been saying a lot of things about building a wall on Mexicans, and maybe I can't get justice in America. And suddenly he is not politically correct. This is
and Chris
the only
is filibustering
thing that these guys
because
have
he's in
say.
Such shaky ground.
I just feel like this is one that Donald Trump should probably move on from. And I feel like he has, for some weird reason, nothing sticks to him. The idea that he wants to
I disagree, Justin. I think that you're forgive me, but you're making the mistake of extrapolating from a primary process of Republicans to a general election. And let's just remember, Trump got 10 million or 11 million votes. Congratulations. But there will be 150 million Americans probably voting in this election. That is a lot more. It's a whole new universe. There are people out there who have no idea about this stuff with Trump. We live and breathe this on a daily basis. Mm. But the majority of people who will be voting in November really have no clue about Trump. And frankly, they don't know a lot about the stuff about Hillary other than they have a general bad feeling in some respects. When Bernie comes home, which he will. Sorry, when Bernie comes to the Democratic Party and tries to and says, I'm good.
For the first time going
Barack
to a Democratic
Obama,
convention.
And Barack Obama and Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders and everybody else is out there, you know, uniting behind Hillary. And Donald Trump continues to inflame everybody else, including independents. Yeah. He is turning off independents. The numbers, I'm telling you, in these polls are going to be changing come September. Look, I've predicted on this show that Hillary's going to win by 12. I am sticking with my prediction.
We'll see how the numbers shake out. And the numbers, this may actually stick to him. I understand that. And I've denounced the thing about the Mexican family lineage.
Finally.
But the whole idea, no, I did it at the top of the program, at the top of the segment. But
yes, but not the 42 times on Facebook I challenged you.
No, that's not true. I did say that. Now, speaking of Facebook, you ought to be getting more friends from what you're saying tonight. I know I am getting more friends. I'm getting them. They're saying hello to me here. But look, it is vitally important that the Democratic hypocrisy on this issue be understood by everybody who is considering it. That's not to excuse Trump. That is to implicate the Democrats in the natural outcome of what they have been pushing. And as to the ultimate disposition of this election, I think the 38,000 jobs that were announced for last month, the fact that we've got a faltering economy, a faltering path of very weak growth to begin with, is much more significant to the average voter than what Donald Trump thinks about one particular judge in one particular lawsuit.
Well, you might want to tell that to Donald Trump.
There you go. Dave Lundy, Chris Roebling, we'll end it there. I want to thank you guys for coming in. We'll see you next Monday. Dave, you're going to be out next Monday?
I am going to be out next Monday.
So maybe Chris... Well, I'll get somebody else. I was just going to have you talk for...
No! No, don't do
okay,
that.
Forget it. I'm canceling my vacation.
Thanks, guys.
See ya.
This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNRadio.com. How you doing, Rob? Sorry I didn't get to talk to you a little bit earlier. We were pressed for time.
I get it.
Roebling and Lundy yelling at each other.
Boy, those guys were like they were shot out of a cannon tonight. That was great.
I have this feel that like they're watching on Sunday the news and then they're like, oh, yes. I got to get on the radio.
Yeah.
They were so hopped up. They argued. I just sent an email maybe around noon today that was like, hey, we good for tonight? What do we want to talk about? And there was a good argument for about maybe like 20 emails. I'm like, save it for air, guys.
Yeah. Yeah, no, you don't want to shoot everything all out at once. I mean, we got to massage this thing. Those guys are great. I love them.
Welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, my guest at the big table tonight is an award-winning mystery author. He's a two-time Edgar Award winner and a New York Times bestseller for his Alex McKnight series. He's out with a new character, which means a new series? We'll find out. The book is called The Second Life of Nick Mason, and it's written by Steve Hamilton. Hamilton's one of the country's great crime fiction writers, and this book takes a look at a Chicago ex-con who's given early release from federal prison, but for a price. It's a great character, and Chicago plays a huge role in this book. Steve Hamilton, welcome to The Download.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
You're not from Chicago, but you got it.
I hope so. The Tribune said I did, so that was like, I was kind of worried, but...
Why set it here?
Well, because, I'm going to flatter you, but this is the greatest city in the world. And if it's not the greatest, it's certainly one of the greatest. And I grew up in a different city, not far away, Detroit, Michigan. Mm-hmm. So I always sort of thought of Chicago as like our sister city. But when I came here, I realized that there's a whole different thing going on here because there are so many worlds inside one city here in a way that I would never really seen anywhere else.
Let's talk about Nick Mason because it's not just sort of like a crime novel that's set in Chicago. I mean, Nick Mason's from Chicago.
Right.
There's a lot that goes in between Canaryville, Back of the Yards.
There's a lot.
There's a very, very specific. How do you research that? I mean, do you know the city well enough to go from neighborhood to neighborhood, or is it more of just getting on the computer and figuring out?
Well, no. I think I have to be here, and I think I know it a lot better now because I spent so much time here writing this book. I was, this book took a year, and I spent a lot of time here just being in Chicago, learning all about this place. Really what it feels like. It always comes down to that. What does it feel like to be in this amazing city and in the different worlds that are inside the city? And then I also spent a lot of time with a homicide detective talking about what it's like to be a cop in this city, mm-hmm. which is not necessarily the funnest thing in the world these days. But I got to see it from his perspective, and I got to talk to a journalist who's lived here his whole life and loves this city and has covered it. So he had a whole different take on this city, too. So I just, you just come and you just be here and talk to people.
Well, I kind of mentioned, in the lead about the idea of Nick Mason being an ex-con who's given early release for a price.
For a price, yeah.
And that's really what the setup of this book is about Nick getting out of prison where he was supposed to be there for a long time and getting an opportunity to have freedom, but he's not really free.
No, if you put yourself in his shoes, you're in federal prison. You're doing hard time. You're doing 25 to life. You know it's going to be a long time before you ever get out, if you ever do. And you're given this offer that will get you out and will let you see your family again. So you take it because you have to. And so he takes this deal, but it's really a devil's bargain that he takes because once he gets out, and by the way, he doesn't just get out.
Mm-hmm.
He gets a whole new life.
Right.
I mean, this is a Canaryville kid who is in prison, and he gets out, and all of a sudden, he's in a Lincoln Park.
He's in Lincoln Park West.
Townhouse. Right. He's driving a 68 Mustang, restored, vintage. He has money in a safe deposit box every month. He's got this beautiful roommate. I mean, he's got everything seemingly that a man could want. But the price of all this is that this deal that he made, when that phone rings, he has to pick it up. And he has to do exactly what he's told to do, no matter what it is, no matter what kind of crime, no matter what kind of horrible thing that he never thought he would do in his life. That's the deal that he made, and there is no way out of it.
That's a great conflict, especially for a mystery novel, because there really is no way out. I mean, for him to get to any sort of semblance of freedom, he's not only going to have to get out of this deal, but he's still essentially, serving it, even if he's not serving it in prison, he's serving it for someone.
Exactly. Yeah. He's gone from one prison to another. And that's really what this whole first book is about, is how he adjusts to that. And he really just starts to think about, how am I going to get out of this? But by the end of the book, he's certainly not out.
We're talking with Steve Hamilton here on The Download. Let's talk about Nick Mason. Where's he come from?
He is a Canaryville kid. That's where he grew up. It just sort of felt like the right place for him. He is a career criminal. I mean, there's no apologizing for that fact of his life. He grew up stealing cars, doing robberies. He tried to go straight when he got married, and he made a terrible mistake one night and did something that he never should have done and broke all of his rules.
Right.
I mean, he has this code. He has these rules that he's lived by his whole life to keep that part of his life separate, and he broke them all one night, and he paid for it, and he went to prison. And that's how this book starts.
Is it tough for you as a novelist and you know, writing crime fiction, is it tough to have the hero be someone who is a career criminal, who inevitably is bad?
Well, that's the challenge of this book and of this series. And yes, by the way, this is only book one of a series. I'm in book two now. And I'm,
okay, great.
I can actually see like seven of them already that I've got sort of laid
wow.
out. Because, I mean, once you get this guy in yeah. this... in this spot where he's got to answer the phone and do whatever he's told, this can take him anywhere. But yeah, I mean, this guy, he is who he is. But it's funny how people are reacting to him, because I mean, I've written about an ex-cop who moves to a very
right.
lonely place. That was the first series with Alex McKnight, and that, you know, at least that's an ex-cop, and that's somebody who was on the right side of the, you know, in quotes, on the right side of things, and is just trying to put his life together. Nick is a whole different type of character, but he gets out, he takes this deal for reasons that you can relate to,
right.
at least. That's as a start. He gets out because he wants to see his ex-wife again. And more than anything, he wants to see his daughter.
His daughter, right.
And she's 9 years old. He's been gone for 5 years, more than half her life. He wants to see her again. That's something that we can all relate to. And we can all connect with them on that level, at least as a start, and then we'll see where it goes from there.
Is that it, for you as a writer? Is it important for you when you're working on a character, especially a character that's featured in a series, to have these redeeming qualities? Where it might be family, it might be, like you said, his rules, his code of rules, like to make him relatable to people who may not want to side with the criminal.
Well, I think that's true with any character, because there's no such thing as an evil, totally evil person. Really, or if there is, it's not very interesting. You know, I think Nick is more interesting because he is a human being first, and he does have more in common with you and me than he has different.
We're talking with Steve Hamilton. The book is called The Second Life of Nick Mason. Nick Mason is his new character, of course. Steve is a best-selling author, New York Times best-selling author. Also, he's won 2 Edgar Awards. We'll continue the conversation. Let's take a quick break. I want to get inside your head about how you set up characters. It's so interesting to me, the idea of creating characters and series. And we'll talk more with Steve when we return. Stay with us. Welcome back to Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest here at the big table tonight, Steve Hamilton, longtime mystery and crime fiction writer, New York Times bestseller for his Alex McKnight series. He's got a new book, The Second Life of Nick Mason, which is out now. Nick Mason, as we mentioned, is a Chicago character. This whole book is set in Chicago, even to the point where he's traveling out to Elmhurst to, you know, he's
right.
going to some of the suburbs. And you mentioned, I mean, you sat down with people from Chicago. How important was it for you to have this character actually be set in Chicago? I mean, could Nick just be a kid from New York and have him in New York? Why bring it here? Why do it in this area? I know you said it's the greatest city.
Yeah, it is. No, there's something, it just felt, it's funny when you first think of a character, you think of where he belongs. And Alex was a Detroit cop, and that's from the beginning. And Nick is a certain kind of guy, and especially because of the fact that he has to leave his home and go away to prison and come back home. And yet it's not home, you know, and Chicago is the great place for that. I mean, if he was a Southsider who went away to prison and he comes back to Lincoln Park, he's back in Chicago. But he
it's
is
a different kind of Chicago,
he is a
yeah.
whole different world. And there aren't that many cities where you have something that it's that pronounced and that just this overwhelming sense of you've left one world and you've entered another one.
Were you able to, as a writer spending a chunk of time here, a year, understand not only the neighborhoods but the politics? I mean, obviously, being with a homicide detective and also with a journalist, you're going to understand more about what's happening here with the Chicago Police Department and the issues of the day.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's kind of some of it's kind of heartbreaking, obviously, some of the stuff that's happened lately. But it sort of goes back mm-hmm. in an unbroken line for a long time, and as you look back in the history of this city, the worst people in this book, ironically, are a crew of sort of corrupt, dirty cops. And you look back in Chicago's history, back not that far, and you find SOS, this special operations section,
right.
that was just running rampant for years and doing things that you couldn't make up. I mean, if you know, it's just they were robbing drug dealers and
right.
kidnapping and torturing, and then one of the ringleaders tried to have another officer killed who was going to cooperate with the investigation. And this was all 10 years ago.
Right. So, this is not 50 years ago.
No, no. This is 10 years ago.
A decade ago.
This isn't Al Capone days. Right. This is 10 years ago. And
did that surprise you as a writer when you came in? You started hearing these stories and getting a little bit more understanding of that code, that broken line.
It did, because I was trying to, you know, I thought I was making up something kind of fantastical, that you had these cops who would just be given this power to go anywhere in the city, and they would use that power just to do the most horrible things.
Yeah, you're a fiction writer.
Just like right. Power, you know, that's what power does. Oh, okay, it turns out there was a crew of cops that did pretty much exactly what I was thinking about, maybe even worse. But then, of course, the thing about if you're writing a book is that you get to make them pay for it. And you get to make the dirty cops pay and the bosses above them who mm-hmm. knew exactly what they were doing and as far up as it goes. You get to make everybody pay because this is a fictional world and you get to have that justice. But in real life, it doesn't always end up that way.
As a fiction writer, how much does your work straddle the line with real issues and things that have happened in real life?
I mean, the best crime fiction does exactly that. The best crime fiction is based on research that comes right out of real life. The Cartel by Don Winslow was the best crime novel last year. And it was based so closely on exactly what's happening in Mexico that you felt like you were just there living in that world. And that's what crime fiction can do. It can really just take you into these places and make you, I mean, there's the old saying that fiction is truer than nonfiction sometimes.
For you, when you're building a character like Nick, where did they come from? I mean, is it the kind of thing where you're like, I got a guy. How do you, as you know, you've been doing New York Times bestseller, I mean, you're Edgar Award winner, where do the characters come from?
Well, you know, I'd been working on this Alex McKnight series for a long time, and I'd done 10 books with him, and it felt like I wanted to do something really different. I took one break, and I did a book called The Lock Artist about a young safecracker, so mm-hmm. you know, that was a really good break, because then I can go back to the series with a whole new energy and be a better writer when I go back. And this time it felt like it was time for something even farther out, something really different, and not just a one-time book, but just to really start a whole new series that I can work on and still come back to the Alex McKnight series. I mean, if you like that series, I hope you like this series too. Mm-hmm. And by the way, in a future book, both of those characters will be in the same book.
That was a question of mine.
Yes, so they're going to run into each other. So that'll be very fun. But
hopefully in a cabin somewhere.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if it's Alex, that's sort of where you have to go to find him. But I was working with a film producer and screenwriter, Shane Salerno, who wrote one of the Avatar sequels and is adapting The Cartel, as a matter of fact, which is why that book was on my mind. And we were just sort of throwing some ideas together, and they sort of collided. And we started with the situation first. He's in this, you know, he's getting out of prison, and he's on call. And everybody he touches, he puts in danger. I mean, there's this instant conflict and drama just from the situation mm-hmm. that he's in. And that really comes from, if you've ever been to a maximum security prison, I mean, part of the research, again, being a crime writer, is to go to these places. And I've been to a maximum security prison, and I've gone inside. It's the most amazing experience you've ever had, because your mind knows you're getting out in 2 hours, and your body doesn't know. Your animal body reaction, your visceral reaction as those doors close is that you're trapped in here. Mm-hmm. You start to think, what if they don't let me out? You know, you start to just think crazy, and your chest tightens, and because everything is different. The air is different. The light is different. There's a smell that's unlike anything else. It's not just a bad smell. It's a smell of despair and hopelessness, and it made me think, that day when I felt that, I have to hold on to this feeling, because someday I'm going to use that as the beginning of an idea, which is, if this was me and I was going in this place and I knew I'd never get out or it'd be a long, long time, what would I do to get out of this place? And right. the answer is pretty much anything.
How much of that is how you write, taking feelings, experiences, emotions that you've had in your lifetime and being able to squirrel them away for when it's appropriate?
That's where some of the best ideas start. And Stephen King says that he compares it to a swamp that you have in your mind as a writer. And all these things go in it, and they all get combined together. And something from one part of your life and this person that you met somewhere else years later, they sort of come together. And it comes out, and something steps out of that swamp, and it's like this whole new thing that's sort of come together.
Yeah.
But those feelings, I mean, for Alex, it was the feeling of being alone in a cabin. And why was he there? Why was he in the most remote place he could find? What drove him there? That was really the first thing that I had with Alex. And with Michael, the lock artist, it was, what does it feel like to be 17 years old and not belong anywhere? Which is a very common feeling that we've all probably gone through. Right. But I just sort of followed that. And the most fun thing about that book was that I got to meet a safecracker and learn about opening safes. And I actually learned how to pick locks for that book. And I still practice every day, because you have to practice lock picking every day or you lose the touch.
Really?
So I've got lock picks on my writing desk and locks. And whenever I have to take a break and clear my head, I'll open up a lock. And some people do yoga, you know, and I open locks. This is what crime writers get to do. This is the worlds that they get to live in, and that's how the research starts, really. It's just feeling it yourself. Yeah.
Steve Hamilton is the author of The Second Life of Nick Mason, which is out now. Steve, of course, is the man behind the Alex McKnight series. Let's take a break for the news, and we come back more with Steve Hamilton. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. My guest tonight at the big table is Steve Hamilton, the author of The Second Life of Nick Mason. Steve is an award-winning author, two Edgar Award winners, New York Times bestseller for his Alex McKnight series. He's got a tremendous, tremendous resume. And Nick Mason's going to be a series. This is just book one. When do you decide that? When does a series pop out of your head?
Well, now that I've been doing this for a while, it was obvious to me from the beginning. This would be a series. Like I said, I'm in the second book now. I really have seven of them all sort of laid out.
And that's usually how it works with mystery novels. Like, you'll get a lot more stories surrounding one character. Why is that?
There's something about the mystery genre that just lends itself to having this one character that you follow from one situation to the other. And then this goes back to Sherlock Holmes. I mean, that was one sort of the first great series character. And it just started this great tradition. Or Philip Marlowe, you know, and the old American hard-boiled hero, which is the stuff I loved so much growing up. Reading myself, because that's writers start out as readers, and that's what I always wanted to do myself.
You know, we've had authors in here before, and you'll hear some of the people talk about the idea of, you know, they were in a career, they're a federal prosecutor, and then they turned to being an author, you know, or things like that. But in your case, you've always wanted to be a writer, and I mean, you've had day jobs, and you continue to have day jobs.
Yeah.
But talk about, you know, what drew you to this? Why mystery?
It feels like I've always been a writer, and it's always what I was going to do when I grew up, you know. But real life does happen, and that's why when I graduated from college, I actually did work at IBM for 30 years. And it was kind of exhausting, because I'd work 8 or 9 hours during the day, and I'd go home late at night after everybody went to bed, and that would be my time. And I would write every night, and I wrote 12 books that way. And all
That's
these
amazing.
Things, you know, these good things happen with the awards and the notable books of the year, New York Times. I mean, all this great stuff happened. So that was enough to keep me going. I felt like I was keeping that promise that I'd made to myself. But it just came a time where with this book, this book felt like it was like my last chance to really break out and just be a full-time writer. That's why this one book was so important to me. And I actually left IBM. When I was writing this book,
wow.
with a new deal with my old publisher, and that's when things got a little crazy.
What you're referring to? You've had an interesting ride in the publishing world, and one that a lot of authors don't usually have. I mean, I'll have authors in here, and they're like, "Oh, I got a 2-book deal and this kind of thing." You turned down or got out of a really big contract with a very good payday. To essentially go to another company. Talk about that.
It was the most terrifying time of my life. It was really just a matter of, I believed in this book so much that I just couldn't let it die.
And that's what you felt was going to happen
here.
That's
what I knew was going to happen. I mean, we had, you know, I'd left IBM. This is St. Martin's Press, my old publisher, who I was loyal to for 17 years. I wrote 12 books for them. They're the only publisher that I ever knew. Mm-hmm. Other authors are telling me, you have to leave these guys, you know, everybody leaves. And I was the one guy who stayed. And I wanted to make this new series with them. I told my agent,
let's do it with them.
Let's not go somewhere else, you know, because I believed that we could do something. So it was, you know, it was such a hard time for me when we were 60 days away from this book being released. I mean, they were literally going to print like the next day. They were going to start running the presses on these books. And we finally saw the marketing plan for this book, and it was, and there was nothing. It was, there was no national media interviews, no.
Which is sort of a sign of the times, right? I mean, less and less publishers are putting anything
towards
the marketing of the book.
That's true. I mean, and that sort of got exposed a little bit in this story, but they had made these promises that everything would be different this time. That after, I mean, I sold a million books for those guys, and this was the book that was going to change that. This was the book that I was going to get national support and really go on a national tour for the first time
and just be a full-time
writer. Yeah, I mean, that's all I ever wanted to do. And it was so heartbreaking to see that this book, it just wasn't going to happen. And so we made the absolutely gut-wrenching decision. It was not easy at all. We have to leave. I mean, that's the last thing that we thought of doing, but it was the only choice because we believed in this book, and we thought it deserved to at least have a shot.
And that's not, to people listening out there, that decision, that's a contract. And that decision, you have to buy yourself out of your own contract. So it's more than gut-wrenching. There's money involved.
That's just one more reason why it was so terrifying. Plus the fact that they were telling us, you just made the biggest mistake of your life. You just ruined your career.
Yeah, you're not going to work anymore, that kind of
stuff. You're done. And so it was, I mean, that, I'm going back to that week. That was just last summer. And but it sort of touched this nerve because, I mean, we were supposed to do it nice and quietly and respectfully, but they sort of took this shot at me on my way out the door and just released this little statement that they were the ones that were canceling the book with no other explanation. And we had to respond to that. And the next thing I knew, it was literally front page on Publishers Weekly. And the whole thing was so overwhelming and so humbling to me because I got so much response from other authors who had been in the same situation or could relate to it.
Right.
And it was just this amazing week of my life where all of a sudden this story was the biggest thing in publishing. And the one thing we had going for us was that manuscript was out there because it was in galleys by then. And the next day, Shane got offers from 10 publishers.
Wow.
And that night, it was like 24 hours later, we agreed to a new deal with Putnam.
Yeah, and it was a big deal.
It was a better deal, but yeah, I mean,
multi-book deal.
But it like really, but it didn't feel like it was about me anymore. Right. You know, it wasn't about me or book deal. It was just, it felt like I was making a bet on myself. As hokey as that sounds, you know, I was standing up. You know, I'm a modest Michigan boy. I'm not that kind of a person who's wants to go out and make a big fuss about it. But
what I love about that story is that it's relatable to any artist.
Yeah.
Who has to make a decision in their life to go full time. And we'll be a musician or, you know, a comedian or whatever it is. At some point or another, they have to jump off. And in your case, even with the success of the Alex McKnight series and selling millions of books, you still had to do that same ritual of jumping off the cliff.
I did. And that's why it was so terrifying. But at the same time, I was so happy when it all sort of resolved itself.
Well, the book is getting good reviews, and people are interested in it. What do you think? I'm always interested in this because the one thing also, like hearing that story, I mean, people will read. They eat up mystery. And that's the one area of publishing where you're going to get the kind of deals we're talking about here. I mean, we're being vague, but we're talking multi, you know, books, you know, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars. For mystery novelists, what is it about the genre that brings people in, that gets such a voracious reader, that continues to make you guys the rock stars of publishing?
Rocks. There's something about crime fiction that just has this sort of elemental appeal to it that always has, you know. And I think it doesn't hurt that there are some really great writers who are working in crime fiction, some of the best writers today. And it doesn't hurt that the form sort of makes you really tell a story. You can't indulge yourself in crime fiction. Or if you do, it just doesn't work.
Yeah, right.
It's what I always loved to read when I was a kid. Elmore Leonard, you know, all these, Raymond Chandler. These guys wrote this just amazing stories that would just draw you in. And there was something so satisfying about working out all these issues of justice and of life and death. There's just something so simple about it and so satisfying, and yet you can keep doing so many different things in it. And I talked about, you know, how a crime writer can make you feel something that other writers maybe can't, like with Don Winslow with the drug wars. Mm-hmm. If you want to know what it feels like to be in the middle of that crazy world, you read that book. If you wanted to know what it was like to be in the hurricane that hit New Orleans, you read James Lee Burke. I mean, these guys, just crime writers know that it's really you really have to get it right.
Obviously, with the Nick Mason series kicking off with the second life of Nick Mason, they'll be set in Chicago for the most part because he's from Chicago, but could go anywhere.
It could go anywhere.
Do you see yourself having to re-immerse yourself into the scenery, the environment, Chicago? Do you have to come back if you're going to do another book and so on and so forth?
Absolutely. I'm here right now, but I'm really just here for – I'm really doing my first national book tour, truly, for the first time.
Congratulations.
So thank you. It's kind of –
How's it everything you
talk
about
exhausting. Yeah, no, on a plane to Denver tomorrow.
Like that, right.
I'm leaving the hotel at like 3 a.m. to get to go do Denver.
This is what you fought for.
This is what I wanted. That's right. But yeah, no, I'm going to be back. Of course I'm going to be back. I mean, this is such a great city. I mean, I really learned that in the year that I've been here. I've just come to love this city so much. I'm looking out the window right now at this beautiful downtown area with walk over the river. Mm-hmm. This is Paris for America. That's what Chicago is.
Do you envision yourself at all in a life of writing without characters, without crime fiction? Meaning, like, could you see yourself working into a different genre than the genre that you've dominated?
No. Why would I? This is the greatest place to be. The people who write this stuff are the greatest people. If you ever get to hang out with all these guys, with Don and with Harlan Coben and Lee Child, these are like the coolest guys, and they're the nicest guys too, because they get to kill people, you know, when they write. So they work it out, and they get it out of their system. But
it's a very cathartic.
It is. It's that's part of the appeal too. Yeah. Is just reading it. But you can do anything in crime fiction. You can go anywhere. You can write any kind of book. All the great social commentary about what it's really like to be up against it these days. That's all in crime fiction. So I wouldn't be anywhere else.
Steve Hamilton is the author of The Second Life of Nick Mason. Of course, Steve is 2-time Edgar Award winner, New York Times bestseller for his Alex McKnight series. It's a great book. Check it out. Steve, I can't thank you enough for spending some time here at the Big
Thank
Table.
You. It was my pleasure.
It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Patty Vasquez up at 11. Coming up at 9 o'clock, we're going to talk with my old friend Kevin Douglas. He's written a play over at Looking Glass. Nice little vaudeville play. Can't wait to talk to him about that. Also, other friends, Carissa Bereka and Tim Mason, will be here from Second City to talk about The Art of Falling, which is being remounted. This was the extremely successful, critically acclaimed show. That was a collaboration between Second City and Hubbard Street Dance that was on, I think, in 2014. So we're losing track of time. So, yeah, so we'll talk with Tim and Carissa coming up. And then at 10 o'clock, we still have to come up with a name, Pete. Have you thought about that at all? Anyone text in and say they like one or the other?
The votes are about equal.
0-0?
No, about 50-50, let's say.
So to refresh everybody's memory, what we're doing on Monday nights now, we're doing live music. We've been doing it for a while, but we're going to expand it. So we moved our segment, The Worst, to Tuesdays. So 10 o'clock is now going to be live music in the studio where we let a band stretch out. They play 3-4 songs, and we get a chance to get to know their music and get to know them. So we want to give a nice – we got to give a segment a name.
Yeah.
And so right now we're talking about The Set List.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of a cool name for like a live music in a studio thing.
Yeah, right? I like it.
And then the other was some, what was it? It was Backstage 435.
The address of Tribune Tower, 435 North Michigan.
We came very close. Pete and I spent like a good hour on this today. But I really liked something, maybe we can talk to Bob about it, like Mix Minus, or like something with the knobs.
Or knobs? How about knobs?
Knobs?
How about playing with knobs?
Playing with knobs. I'm just going to read the stuff that I see here.
Don't touch anything.
Yeah, insert, direct out, balance, unbalance, mic pre. Any of these really ringing a bell? No, these don't work?
Nah. Yeah. They're not as catchy as Setlist.
Digital Signal.
Ah.
Delay. Dump, start, spots. All right, so that's
kind of what we were doing. We're just talking. We were just saying words.
All right, so we need to come up with a name for the segment. Regardless, the featured act tonight is Max the Fox, which I'm very excited. Their music is great. A good Chicago band, a good indie rock, folk pop quintet.
They're here.
They're here. Mm-hmm. They got a cello. It's always good. Throw a cello on Michigan Avenue.
Yeah.
How was the weekend, bud?
It was good.
Yeah?
Yeah, yours?
It was good. We were at the same ball game yesterday. The
yeah.
Game. You and I refused to see each other, though. We were on different parts of the stadium, and we're like, it's too much to walk. We see each other all the time. We don't need to, you know what, we both know we're here. We're adults. It's a lot of adults in this building. I did not know. You go to way more Cubs games than I do. This was my first and probably the last of the season. I'm going to make my transition to Sox Park soon here.
Good.
Chris Bryant, warm it up, Chris. Is that new?
He's been doing that, yeah.
Because yeah,
we went to game last
rap,
week.
Yeah. The classic hip-hop
yeah.
track.
Love
warm it up, Chris. I'm about to.
Yeah.
That's his walk-up music.
Yeah.
Yeah. Really? Is it a tongue-in-cheek is he going with?
No, I think he likes it. I kind of like it, too. You don't like it?
I mean, I like it. It's just abnormal for a walk-up song. The Cubs' walk-up songs were very uninspiring. You know, you've talked about it on the show. You've talked about the different, you know, the Bad Blood and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. Last year they did Trap Queen over and over, right? Uninspire, I mean, it was nothing. I did not feel like any of these guys had good taste. Dexter Fowler, maybe.
Yeah, because he rotates between Future and Drake pretty much.
Yeah, I was like, okay, there we go. Then Zobrist does his wife's song.
Yeah.
Which is really, I don't know. I mean, it's a catchy tune.
Yeah, and, you know, throwing her a bone, if you will.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess if you will.
You don't like Matt Sheezer's Renegade song? Which I thought was just a Jeep jingle, but it actually turns out it's a pop song.
Now, we need to talk about the tracksuits. The Chicago Cubs got ready for their road trip, and when they got on the bus, they all had tracksuits. They all had matching tracksuits, and their nicknames were on the back.
Uh-huh.
Now, if you're a listener to this show, you know that we are in the middle of giving each member of the 2016 Chicago Cubs a legitimate, authentic nickname, not one that they come up with, not one that's like, because baseball players are not very clever. They just go, you know, Zo. That's just one syllable touch. Good job, Mac. Right? His name's going to be Mac. And you're like, that's no good. It's got to be something a little bit more. We got to put some. So we've been crowdsourcing. And today, on the back of those tracksuits, they all had their nicknames.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like that was a shot across the bow.
It was.
Like, I felt they listened to our segment, they listened to our show, and they're like, we're gonna up the ante on nicknames. Each one of them. And it was like Lack for Lackey.
They were terrible.
They're terrible. Zo for Zobrist. I'm like, come on.
Pedro Strop was Stropey.
See, we've already established that you can't do what the NHL
right.
does
right.
in just doing Taser and Kaner and
right. And
lame.
That's, all of them were like that.
Wouldn't it be great if Strope had White Castle on the back? That makes sense.
Strope's nickname is White Castle because he's got the best slider in the business.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of my favorites. Dexter Fowler played yesterday, free range. I was yelling out the nicknames, trying to get them to stick. So when Dexter Fowler came up, I went, all right, free range! The guy next to me is like, what is that? I'm like, free range. It's like, you know, like foul chicken. Like he's free range center fielder. Yeah. Everyone calls him free range. What's the matter with you? Do you not pay attention? and Zobrist, I'm like, come on, Zor. I did Hectoro because he was warming up. And I go, hey, all right, Hectoro. And they're like, what's Hectoro? And I'm like, Hectoro, like Toro, the bull. Like
you should just turn him. Yeah. Just hashtag it, will you?
Hashtag it. I'm a Twitter user. I'm verified. Come on, man. Pay attention. Yeah, so they've upped the ante with the nickname game, so we have a good one on Wednesday. All right?
Yeah.
It's got to be a star, I think, on Wednesday. I think we got to bring it back, the heat. So think about one of the corners, maybe.
Chris Bryant?
Bry? Welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Well, the Looking Glass Theater is going vaudeville this summer. Well, they're doing a play about vaudeville. Thaddeus and Slocum, a vaudeville adventure, opens this weekend. It runs till August 14th. The play tells the story of a Chicago duo on the circuit in 1908. What's stopping them from becoming the next great stage act? Thaddeus is black and Slocum is white. Will they let racial boundaries of the early 20th century destroy their dreams of making it big? We'll find out. The play is written by Kevin Douglas. Douglas is a Looking Glass Theater ensemble member who has roots in Chicago sketch comedy. His group Kavinda was a huge hit here in Chicago. They went to the Aspen Comedy Festival. I had the great pleasure of working with Kevin Douglas. We just talked about it back in 2008. It's now 8 years, man.
Yes.
Last time. Good to see you. I saw you on the street about maybe a year ago. Mm-hmm. Good to see you. Always a big fan of yours. And congrats on your first play. This is your first play?
Yeah. Yeah.
Where does this come from? For you as an actor, I mean, I've known you as an actor and a writer, but I mean, mostly in sketch comedy. Where did the idea come from to write a play?
To write this play? Well, when I was younger, I watched a lot of old movies. I loved comedy, especially old movie comedies. And when I got older, I discovered Turner Classic Movies. Mm-hmm. It was like all my favorite movies on one channel. And I noticed that there weren't a lot of people that looked like me in these movies. And so I thought, what would a play with a black lead that wasn't a slave maid or Sidney Poitier, what would a play that was a comedy and had the racial boundaries of the time period look like? You know, it took place in the olden days.
Right.
And that's how Thaddeus and Slocum was born.
So, I've known you, you know, the idea, you could make that a sketch, you could make that, how you could do a lot of things with, you could do improv, whatever it is. Why go the route of writing a play?
A play, well, with a play, it allows you to breathe, the play has to breathe and you have to develop the whole universe, right? And I wanted it, there were so many themes in it that it had to expand, right? With a sketch, as you know, it's like boom, boom, boom.
Right.
Get to the joke. And oddly, the first few drafts of the play, Heidi Stillman, who is our New Works development head of our artistic director as well, she's in the first few drafts, she said, Kevin, these scenes are kind of like sketches.
Right. No, the way I write sketches is I just do an outline and I improvise the rest.
Exactly.
That's different.
Exactly.
Okay, so let's talk about you saw these moves, but what did you know about vaudeville? I mean, because your show was kind of vaudevillian, if you think about it, the show you did with Inda. I mean, mm-hmm. sketch show, and you're moving, you know, sort of from, you know, song, dance, all that kind of stuff. But what did you know about vaudeville before you wrote about it?
Yeah, I didn't know that much, but the stars of the movies that I loved, many of them came out of vaudeville, like Judy Garland, Gene Kelly, Danny Kaye, Charlie Chaplin, all of them came out of vaudeville. And so the more I researched, the more I realized that. And I knew that I wanted the play to live in there and be the thread for the main characters.
The first thing, you know, when I was pitched at Kevin Douglas as a new play, I'm like, oh, Kevin Douglas, we're going to do, all right. I know he's doing Looking Glass stuff. I'm dying to talk to him. And then I looked at it, and I haven't seen the play, but I looked at it, and I'm like, Kevin's not in this. Is it hard for you to write something that you're not in?
No. As an actor, no, actually, because we hired a lot of really top, you know, top actors for the show. If they were terrible, yeah, it would be very challenging to watch it.
Here's
what I would do.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you feel like, okay, cut from the back. Cut. Hi, I'm Kevin. I'm the writer. If I could just jump in right now, I'll show you what you're supposed to do. Do that?
I love that you said cut.
Yeah, right. Freeze? Is that better? Freeze?
Freeze? Freeze? Actors freeze?
Thank you. Freeze. Sorry, Kevin, the writer.
Here's what I would do. Could you? Right.
How much are you involved in the actual production as a writer of a play? I mean, I'm thinking of what we know more about writing for comedy, for television, for movies. You write the stuff and they don't want you around. Is it how similar is it in the theater for someone who wrote a play?
Sure. For Looking Glass, it's very collaborative. The whole process is pretty collaborative. I did think that I would be doing a lot less. I thought I'll be writing and just put it to the side. But the directors, Nikki Brooks and Chrissy Vanderwalker, they've been really accepting of my suggestions or notes, right? But they've been really great. And of course, they find the times where they're like, "Okay, Kevin, yeah, move away, go. That's enough. We'll take it from here."
You've been through a couple previews now. You've watched how are the audiences responding to jokes about race? I mean, you're talking about. I'm obviously a lot of the issues in this play are probably relevant to what we're going through today, knowing you. but talk about how is the audience responding to the jokes that, you know, I've always known you to be very upfront about race and make humor out of it, but not everybody, as I found out, wants to necessarily laugh at that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it's been interesting to hear the different responses from black people and white people. So it's been. I'll say this: there is some blackface in the show, and when we rehearsed a scene recently that we changed a bit, and I turned around and looked, and most of the people in the room were white, and they really amped it up, and the actor amped it up, and I looked around the room, and everyone was kind of in their computer and just looking down,
right.
Because it was pretty intense. Yeah, and sitting in the audience and watching the audiences respond has been, I've seen head shakes, and I think they're really taking in and really going inward and thinking about their connection to race, mm-hmm. and how they can, I don't know, what they're doing, I guess. I hope that they leave thinking, what am I doing that could help the problem, you know, or what can I do to help the problem?
Is that what you're going for, is to try and get people to think about their perspective on race, or is it just sort of to be entertained and to walk away? I mean, it's got to be hard as a comedian. I know you as a comedian to write jokes that people are going to go shake their head at.
Yeah, I've always, or the way that when I worked with Indo, one of the things we focused on was making sure that we had a point of view in every sketch. And I think that's carried over into my playwriting. And it's kind of helped drive the piece, you know, knowing what you want to say will help guide it and keep it focused. So, yeah.
Talking with playwright Kevin Douglas, his show Thaddeus and Slocum, A Vaudeville Adventure, opens this weekend. It runs till August 14th. We'll take a quick break. Come back more with Kevin. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Coffin. My guest, Kevin Douglas, in studio. His new play, he's a playwright now. He used to be a sketch comedian, but he got too big for us. Thaddeus and Slocum, A Vaudeville Adventure, opens this weekend and runs till August 14th at the Looking Glass Theater. Kevin, of course, was a sketch comedian, worked in a group called Kavinda, among other stuff, and is now an ensemble member at the Looking Glass. Mm-hmm. Was it tough to make a transition from sketch comedy? Because, I mean, that's what you were in with sketch comedy to straight theater here in Chicago?
Yeah, it almost happened simultaneously. I took a big chunk of time where I was just in sketch with Inda, and then we would both individually just audition for other shows, but we would still do sketch. And then, yeah, and then I auditioned for a show at Looking Glass and then got in there and then did another show. And then now I'm an ensemble.
How do you like
member.
The life of being an ensemble member? You know, because an ensemble member at a theater means, you know, means so much different than what it means to be part of an improv group.
Yeah, I like the private jets are great.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
Tahiti, every...
It's Joey Slotnick, you know. It's David Schwimmer money.
Yeah,
I know.
That's
sure.
right. No, it's great because it's a family. Not that sketch isn't a family, but you really marry into this group, you know, and everyone joins together for this one show or this one company to make it the best it can be, and everyone jumps in. Sketch and improv, it's a little more loose.
Yeah, right.
Know? Inda and I stay together. Schadenfreude, you guys stay together.
Most don't, right.
Right. Yeah, they break up after, you know, one run of a show or what have you. But, yeah, there's a tight bond, I think, with ensemble.
Well, I was all prepared to talk to you, did my research on talking to Kevin about what it's like to stay here in Chicago, to not move to Los Angeles. And then he came in here and you're like, I'm living in L.A. now. What? Why the transition? Why did you? Why are you leaving Chicago?
Oh, I want to be rich and famous.
Yeah, sure.
So, no, yeah, I right. Mean, of course. No,
that's your mission statement. Right. Right.
Rich and famous. No, I moved to L.A. because that's been the plan forever. I've been trying to go there, and I want to write. I want to write for television, and I love Chicago, but there's just not a lot of opportunities for that here. And so my wife and I, we said, okay, let's do it. You know, we're going to move out there and do it. And then, sure enough, we moved out there, and then...
You're back for this show.
I am back.
She's back. She got cast in something.
Yeah, she got cast in a TV show, so now we'll be back.
So you're back. It just brings you back.
Right.
You know, one thing about Kavinda, with you and Inda... you guys were, I don't know what the stats were, but there weren't a lot of African-American sketch groups in Chicago in the late 90s and 2000s. Maybe here or there some people working that were on the sets at Second City. But talk about, I mean, from your vantage point, your point of view, is Chicago is it a favorable city for African-Americans who want to be in sketch and improv?
Yeah, I think it's gotten a lot better. When we were... When we were doing the tours and doing all the festivals, we would be the only group, and that alone would make us stand out. Yeah. You know, luckily our stuff was strong. We weren't just, oh, they're only good because they're black. You know, but no,
that's what we were all saying in the back. We're like, you know, Kevin and Inda, they're only good because they're black. Right. Oh, here they come.
Exactly. No, but there weren't a lot. They're just, even when we went to the Aspen Comedy Festival, there was not a lot of, you know, Hari Candable.
I don't know.
He's a comedian. I think it was us, and he's Indian, and so it was the three of us, you know, pretty much.
And you found yourself a lot like that. I mean, how were the audiences? Because you guys had, and I always loved your show, and there were a lot of sort of black humor in it. There was a lot of sort of the point of view, taking on race, taking on racism. Mm-hmm. But how are audiences responding to you? Because you primarily played on the north side, didn't you? I mean, I don't know your whole where you were playing all the time, but it felt like the shows that I saw were at theaters on the north side of Chicago.
Our sketch group?
Yeah,
north side, because that's where most of the sketch houses were. Mm-hmm. So yeah, we mostly played on the north side, and then we tour all over. Tour. We went to different. We paid for our plane tickets and our hotels, and went to different festivals.
How did? Right. But how? When you guys were doing that kind of material to a primarily white audience at I.O. or Second City, mm-hmm. what was the response?
It was interesting. Sometimes it would hit, especially it became more north south, or depending on the city. It so here all the race stuff would kind of hit, and the race stuff would hit, and then we would do some things in other places where they weren't sure they should laugh.
Right, right.
I don't know if we should laugh at this. You know, it's a comedy show. Oh, one time we did, this was when Obama was Senator Obama, we did a sketch and killed here, right? Then we went to Toronto at the Toronto Festival, and we made the joke. Crickets.
What was the joke?
It was, oh my goodness.
It was a long time ago.
Yeah, it was so long ago.
But, 10 years ago.
Yeah, but he was popular here, and we forgot we should not do that sketch there because...
No one knows who he is.
Right. Right. Now everyone knows him.
I've had black comedians in, and they talked about the relationship. Like, a lot of black stand-up comedians will go to the north side to play at Laugh Factory or to play at other comedians. You know, they play where the venues are. For you guys, did you ever notice a difference of playing to a white audience and a black audience? As a black ensemble, or the two of you doing sketch comedy, did the jokes play as well to a black audience?
Yeah, and we sometimes, and I probably won't admit to this, but sometimes we would choose certain jokes like, oh, we got to do that here because it's going to kill
here.
Okay, let's not do that there because they're not going to get it. So, yeah, there were times, and we would set it up so that, you know, our good stuff was at the top and bottom so that, you know, they got them right in the beginning. And then that's how you set up a sketch show, everyone. You start strong and end strong. Yeah.
Yeah, so. Exactly. All right, so Kevin, what's next for you? I mean, here this play it's just starting up, so I mean, this is a big deal for you. Are you going to continue playwriting? Is that something that you're going to do? I mean, you said you want to do television writing. Mm-hmm. What's the next move for you, Kevin Douglas?
Yeah, I am developing another play, and it's a it's a farce about reparations. So
Sure. Yeah. It's very farcical. Yeah. It's a topic I would definitely. And farce too.
Yeah, so that I'm writing a couple web series. My wife and I have a web series. We're developing a sketch web series that we're doing. And yeah, I'll be back here and writing and acting.
Well, that's Chicago's gain. Looking Glass Theater's Kevin Douglas. He's an ensemble member there. His new show, Thaddeus and Slocum. He wrote this play, Thaddeus and Slocum, Vaudeville Adventure, opens this weekend, and it runs till August 14th. Kevin, great to see you. Good luck with your endeavors, and I hope to talk to you again soon, buddy.
Good to see you, Justin. Thanks for having me.
All right. Coming up, we're going to talk with Tim and Carissa. I'm excited to talk about The Art of Falling, Second City Hubbard Street collaboration, dance comedy. Great to talk to Kevin. I saw Kevin on the street, like I said, like we walked by each other about a year ago. But we worked together at Steppenwolf for that show, and he reminded me the show was Traffic Series. It was a Traffic Series. I think I call it Crossroads Traffic, whatever. But it was about race. It was the whole thing was Schadenfreude and Kavinda came in to explore race. It was like almost that was what their theme was, and then different shows. Like I think it was like a Friday night show, and we did a sketch show about race. I don't remember any of the jokes. I remember one joke where at the beginning of the show, the joke, and it hit, and it could have not, and we were like questioning whether or not, but we go, it was like we were introducing ourselves, so I think Kevin and I were on stage, maybe Inda was, but he said, hi, I'm Kevin, I'm with the group Kavinda, we are a African-American group that is a point of view of black comedy, you know, here in Chicago, and I'd be like, and I'm Justin from Schadenfreude, we're normal. That was the joke. And we were... And the crowd died, which was great. But I was like, that's a good way to start a show about race, right?
You can't say that.
That's funny. He's a very funny guy, and I'm very proud of him to be writing his first play at Looking Glass. How great is that? It's The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock. One of the big stage hits of 2014 was a collaboration between Second City and the Hubbard Street Dance Company. The Art of Falling played to great reviews and sold out houses back then. So why not bring it back? The Art of Falling will be back on stage at the Harris Theater in Millennium Park from June 9th to the 19th. In studio with me tonight are two of the writers on the project, Tim Mason and Carissa Bereka. Tim, Carissa, thanks for being here. Good to see you guys.
Aw, thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us, Justin.
All right, so let's get right to, I mean, for you guys to bring this back, what does it mean to bring it back? Because it was such a success. I mean, past the point of just great, you know, great feedback from the audience, but the critics just love this thing. Well, I mean, is it fun to bring something like this back?
Oh, yes, absolutely. And it was such a collaboration that, and it took so much time to create that the four shows we did originally just did not seem like
right,
enough.
Right. It's only, it was like a lot, months on this thing, right?
Oh, months, a year. I mean, honestly, a year. And then the dance world just operates different than the comedy world so that they spend all this time perfecting it. And they're like, well, we did it four times. That was great.
That was a lot of times.
Yeah, it was a lot of times. Yeah, you know, we used to do eight shows on the main stage. You'd be like, this isn't even Thursday. It's what I felt like. So bringing it back is fantastic. It's one of the things I'm most proud to ever have been a part of.
And you've been a part of a lot. I mean, you've your own sketch group, and you did Second City, main stage, the whole bit. So, I mean, for you to say that about this project, I mean, why this project over all the other stuff that you've done with the company?
Well, this is so unlike everything else I've done before in that it's so unlike anything, really. It's its own piece of theatrical work that's hard to describe, but the reason I like it so much is that it has a lot of great laughs. I mean, really, really funny laughs, but at the same time, it's grounded in such emotion, and it explores some topics that you don't normally get to do when there's a bunch of drunk bachelorettes out in the crowd, you know? So it's like we're in a beautiful theater, and we're able to kind of take comedy a little more seriously, you know, and like actually elevate the art of comedy a little bit. I just love it. I'm so proud to be a part of it.
So. Oh, yeah.
Well, the show is called The Art of Falling Down, and there's something great about that because, you know, the title itself is something that applies to both comedy and dance. I mean, obviously, falling down on stage and dance is pretty obvious.
Yeah.
But in comedy, there's a lot of falling down. I mean, there's a lot of risk-taking. There's more than just, you know, slipping and falling on the stage. Talk about, I mean, is that sort of the idea behind Art of Falling, that you're exploring the different storylines that both are in dance and comedy?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we explore everything, like, from, like, kind of a more heightened reality to a very grounded, like, storyline. There are, like, three storylines that kind of weave itself through the piece. And, like, one of them is, like, very heightened, almost cartoonish. And then there's very, like, grounded, like, tearjerker ones that have, like, just such beautiful moments in them. And I think in both worlds, like, the idea of falling, like, in love, falling, like, just like on your face, like there's so many different ways to think of what falling means.
Yeah. And you know, the whole show ends, I'm not going to give anything
give
away.
It away.
Give it away.
Spoiler alert.
I mean, the bloodbath hits. No,
yeah, right.
It's, but the very last line is actually a quote from Sheldon Patinkin, that after we had named it The Art of Falling, after we had put these themes through, we kind of knew that there's this moment where it was like, we want to leave you in the words of Sheldon Patinkin, and Sheldon had just died right before that happened, and we were frantically trying to think of like what is the final thing that we say. And then we found in the Second City coffee table book that, you know, like,
yeah,
they give out with coffee, there's this, the last line says something like, in the book says like, I leave you in the words of the great Sheldon Patinkin, and he's like, it's better to, if you're gonna fall, it's better to land on your feet, and if you can't do that, at least get a laugh while you're trying.
That's so great.
And we saw these words, and we're like, "Well, there's the end
there
of the
it
show.
Yeah.
We got it." And it all just stuff like that. When we were writing it, it all came together kind of magically a little bit.
Krista, let me ask you: how much did you know about dance, and more importantly, the industry that is dance? Because you know, it's not just about moving. I mean, there's a lot that goes into dance and the world of dancers. How much did you know before you started this project?
Well, luckily, like, actually, I was a dancer in college, and I minored in that. And then I also have a dance company here in Chicago. So it kind of just it's a dream to do this because it's like my two favorite things in the whole world, comedy and dance, just meshed into one beautiful creation. So, I mean, I do have a background in it, and there was a definite, like, still a learning curve of like, oh, we have to translate for the comedians into like dance,
right,
and dance and for the comedians. And there was like, I did feel like a translator at points for
well,
like, the
good.
Dancers.
I mean, that's great to have on the staff.
Oh,
I mean,
yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I would think that in some cases you were doing a show that would be collaborating with a dance company. And there's probably a lot of Second City writers who don't know anything about dance. It would just go to the stereotype.
Yeah, I mean, well, absolutely. And I had never seen a dance show before in my life until I signed up to do this. And then went to the first Hubbard show, and I was completely, I was like, oh, this is not what I thought it was at all. You know, I didn't, in my head, it was either going to be like bad, like ballet that you see, like, and like, I think my extent of ballet I had seen is the ballet scene in Top Secret, the movie.
Oh, right?
I mean, like, terrible.
That's what you had in your
that's
head.
That's what I had in my
that's
head.
Like,
I was
dance.
Like, oh my gosh, this is what dance is going to be.
Nothing like that scene. Right?
I know. No, so like seeing this, it's like, oh, it's wonderful. And then having Carissa, who was able to kind of speak both languages.
Yeah.
And then, you know, these choreographers, you know, we're in the show.
Oh
we're
goodness.
Dancing in the show too. And they think some of these words are normal things that normal people know, but they're not. Like, all right, now you just flingulate everywhere. And you're like, what was that word again? And then Carissa would explain it.
There was one day, on our first days in the studio, I think one of the choreographers was trying to figure out, like, he just looked at us. He could not figure out what we were. Like, he was, like, trying to make his move, like these beautiful dancers did. And I think he was just like, I don't know what to do. And he goes, you know, just prance. And we ended up just like prancing around the room for like a good, and we, in our own beautiful ways, I think we made something gorgeous out of that. I mean, we really pranced all over that room.
That's good. That's, you're prancers. That's good. Yeah. Tim Mason and Carissa Brecka in studio with me. The show is called The Art of Falling. It's a collaboration between Second City and the Hubbard Street Dance Company. Let's take a quick break. The show is going to be at the Harris Theater at Millennium Park from June 9th to the 19th. We'll continue the conversation after this. Stay with us. Welcome back to Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. We're talking about The Art of Falling, the collaboration between Second City and Hubbard Street. It's going to be remounted at the Harris Theater at Millennium Park from June 9th to 19th. I think dance is one of the best art forms in all of performance. And when I watch it, I'm always like, this is so amazing because it does what I think theater does in comedy as well. It puts human beings in a position where you're like, I can't do that. They're much better than me in every facet of the world. And so I get do you feel the audiences that are coming to this, are they dance audiences or are they comedy audiences?
I mean, I think we're spanning both of the genres with this, and it's so great. And it's also like a theater audience too, because people who've never seen dance are coming to see this and like being inspired, and people who have never seen comedy, like these are just people that don't like think that what comedy is in Second City is a stand-up, are coming to see this and having a whole new appreciation for like sketch and the whole world of Second City. So I think this is a real like genre bending experience.
Yeah. We've only done it four times really in town. So,
but from my four-time experience.
But there was, you know, that last run, it was, and this could now be an urban legend that's been passed down to me, but that by the end, there were people lined up outside being turned away. And that last show, you got the feeling that it was
something
that had turned the corner, because the laughs were a little longer. Mm-hmm. The blue humor got a few more laughs. And like,
I mean, I would say, I will say what, and Tim Mason, Carissa Brecka are in studio with me, but I would say that my caveat of saying that dance is the best, it's also, it needs comedy. Yeah. A lot of times it needs, like if it had a Second City sketch inside of it and it was worked in, I'm liking what I'm hearing.
I think you like it. Well, you know, so much of that dance stuff is out of context, mm-hmm. you know, and it's like, especially contemporary dance like Hubbard is really beautiful stuff that is also sometimes for me as a writer, you're like, okay, what are you trying to say?
Right. What's the POV on this?
Yeah.
Right.
So just adding a little bit of context to some mm-hmm. of these movements in a way, I think elevated their stuff. And then it by far elevated our stuff, you know, where we would always laugh for like in a Second City show, you'd have five chairs and that's an airplane. But here it's like you have 30 people and they're moving beautifully.
So you were able to use the dancers to be able to do object work.
I mean,
that's great.
The best object work you've ever seen.
the most leotarded object work of all time.
Yeah,
it is the most leotarded Second City show, I think, of all time.
I really like this word. That's just
I just made it leotarded. You guys both worked on the collaboration you did with the opera, with the Lyric Opera. Just you, Tim.
Not me.
Oh, you didn't work on that?
No, I didn't.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay. Uh-uh. So talk about, Chris, that. I guess the question I have is, like, do most arts companies work in the same way? Because at Second City, there's something great about the idea of the way that you've developed and put together a show on stage, and you know, it's very loose and it's very improv and you try things. When you're working with another company, a different discipline, everything across the board, is it difficult to communicate when it comes to how you guys sort of operate and be able to collaborate?
I would say every company is different. Like, I was not a writer on the Lyric show. I was a performer in it, and that was an amazing experience as well. So I can only speak from a performance perspective, but it was a definitely different vibe than the Hubbard show. I feel like for the Hubbard show, there were, I don't know, 25 collaborators, I feel like, because all the dancers were involved and the choreographers were involved and the writers.
Musicians.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, the musicians. There's so many people involved in that collaboration. And again, I can't speak to how many people were involved in the Lyric, but especially when we got to the stage, it was not that many. It was too opera singers. And then, of course, Patrick Stewart and Renee Fleming were also there, I think.
I think, outside of when all the actors and the dancers and the choreographers got in a room, we all collaborated really well together. I think that Yes And stuff really actually worked on both ends, and we were all speaking the same language. I think the hardest stuff was probably like the organizations collaborating together. And like one is a Second City's like a for-profit comedy club that has all this stuff, and then Hubbard's this non-for-profit. Like, I think watching the organizations, it's helped elevate stuff at Second City even afterwards, you know. Like, I think everybody was kind of working together, like all across the administrations even.
So it did work. The collaboration did work between the choreographers and the artists and the comedians sort of take that ethos, that Yes And, let's all be one big ensemble. Because like you said, I mean, you're talking 30 plus people in a room. Mm-hmm.
You should have heard some of the conversations that a choreographer and I would have together, like me trying to explain what I think. I'm like, I don't know. Robin Minek. She was kind of choreographing the things I was working on. And I said, I kind of see it like water kind of like going down a drain. And, you know, and she'd be like, okay, so you want water going down a drain? I'm like, no, I'm just, these are, I don't know.
Images?
I guess I want like a circle.
I want it in dance water. Water.
Right. Yeah, please, just make it pretty. Okay.
Did you have a concept? I mean, obviously this is not and that's what I really like about this project, is it's not a sketch show that you do a sketch and then, oh, okay, here's Hubbard Street with a dance. I mean, it is so written to be integrated. Mm-hmm. So was that, I mean, did you have, as one of the head writers, Tim, did you have in your mind how that would go?
Not really. You know, I think we walked in there thinking, okay, we're going to do some version of where Second City goes to a town and makes fun of the town's, you know, like oddities. And we'll do that for dance. And then we saw the show, and at least for me and I think Billy and I think all of us, we were like, I don't want to make fun of this. I want to use this as a tool to create something new. And, you know, the closest thing that I can draw a parallel to is it's kind of like you go see a musical, and the music propels the story forward, and the music is woven into the show, and you don't know where the music ends and the story begins. You know, it's just part of what it is. This is like substitute music for dance, and the dance is just as integral to the story. I mean, the climax of this show is a dance move, you know, and that when we... Also, we didn't know if that was going to work. You know, like, I mean, we really, you're like, well, it's a dance move. Like, good luck. Okay, good luck. Like, can't wait to hear the booze on this, you know. But I remember the first time we did that finale in the room, and suddenly everyone was crying. And you're like, well, at least 40 people like it.
Yeah.
You know, and like,
that's a good number of people.
Yeah, I mean, that was great. Yeah, you know, right. Like a pretty big thing. Take that. So then that's when we went off and tried it then.
Do you both, as comedians and performers and writers, from this experience, the experience of putting together this for a year and getting a chance to remount it, how has it changed you as performers? I mean, Carissa, you already had a dance background, but getting a chance to work comedy dance with Hubbard Street, how did it make you a better performer?
I mean, in every possible way. But I mean, just creatively, I can't tell you how many times I'm like, this is cool, but how can I heighten this now? Like, I feel like nothing is impossible now for some reason, because this seemed so impossible when we started. And then everything just, can I do this? I want to do this. Yes, you can do this. And we can make it even better than you thought it would be. I mean, I think now everything I create, I can be like, I know this can be better. And I know it can be heightened because I've seen it. Yeah.
What about you, Tim?
It's totally changed me. I think it has made me respect just the writing and the comedy as kind of an art form. And so much of comedy is disposable nowadays, you know, where people literally pull out their phone and they throw it up and they think that's it. That when these dancers who are all sitting around like reading like Proust and doing New Yorker articles, and when they'd be like, this was really good. You're really good at what you do. it suddenly made you be like, yeah, you know what, I am. Yeah. It's changed me into writing like longer stuff and like trying to make that transition out of just throw away comedy to throw away comedy to theater. Yeah.
The show is called The Art of Falling. It was a big hit in 2014. It's back. It'll be on stage at the Harris Theater at Millennium Park from June 9th to June 19th. In studio, two of the writers, Carissa Bereca and Tim Mason. Thanks for both for being here. Congratulations on the success of the show.
Thank you.
Thank you. Double congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And thanks for being here, and I'll see you guys soon.
Thanks, Justin.
This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNRadio.com. Coming up, Max DeFox, live music here in the Allstate studio, the Showcase studio. We got to come up with a name still for this, but we're going backstage 435 or the set list. I'm digging on the set list, but I feel like there's probably 6,000 bits that are called the set list.
You think so?
Feel like it. I feel like if I were a musician doing a podcast, I'd be like, you know what we call it, man? It's called the set list. So, yeah. And then they just all fiddle on the guitar and then they fall asleep.
Well, the 435, that yeah. You know, that right away, that excludes a lot of people.
Anyone who's at 435 North Michigan is the tower here, Tribune mm-hmm. Tower. So maybe that could be 435 Michigan. 435. Studio 435. Set list 435. Microphone 435. All right, I'll figure it out.
Yeah, we'll come up with it. We got 8 minutes.
All right, we need Mark Tier. He's a name guy.
I got to research. Yeah. You know me.
Research the building. Right. Esmeralda will judge. We need a name for this for our music segment, Esmeralda. That's the we're going to do live music. Max DeFox is the first band tonight. We're going to extend our live music Mondays. But we're thinking something with 435, like the name of the band or the building, 435 North Michigan. Mish.
No, no.
Justin went to not Columbia the College. The Columbia College mascot is...
All right. Yeah, that okay, out. That's a swipe right. in me. I got it. All right.
Yep.
That's fine. Yeah, that Make starts. Fun.
It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, it's time for our new Monday night feature. We're still working out the name, but right now we'll just call it Set List 435.
Nice.
Such a cop-out. We'll figure it out. It's a Monday night jam session here that will feature some of the best and brightest Chicago bands working today, performing live, full tilt, in studio for you. We've been doing it for the last year on the show, but we've expanded it because, to be fair, you know, to Bob and all the bands that bring stuff in. I mean, you bring so much equipment in here. If you're watching on the webcam, I mean, you see this is transformed into a studio. And then what we've been doing in the last 6 months, it's like, okay, play that song. Great. Get out of here.
Yeah. So, pack it all up. Go home.
So we decided for everybody's sake, including the audience at home, we're going to spread this out a little bit, get a couple more songs in, and really enjoy the music that Chicago has to offer. Tonight, we bring you the orchestral folk pop sounds of Chicago's Max DeFox. The quintet just put out a new album called From the Deer Forest. Their music is definitely rock and roll, but features stringed instruments like viola and cello and the weird bass. The quintet is Corey Simonson on guitar and keys, Jacob Fawcett on drums, Sarah Cornish on viola, Rachel Schultz on cello, and Marlon Aguilar on guitar. All of you are singers, I believe. So yeah. They're playing Tonic Room on Saturday night, and they're here with us in studio.
Hello.
Thanks for being here.
Thanks
Marlon and
us.
Corey are on the microphone here.
Thanks
so
for
talk,
having us.
Talk a little bit. When I say orchestral folk pop, what does that mean?
It's a mashup of what I think what we sound like, right?
Sure. It's, you know, it's hard to find a genre, or it's hard to find, like, I don't know, what are we, right? What do we sound like? So we're like, well, we have viola, we have cello, you know, we have that orchestral
layer
to us. So yeah.
Where does it come from you guys? I mean, was that the intention when you put the band together to have that kind of orchestral vibe to it?
We always wanted to have strings as part of the music that we were making. It just took a little bit to get all those pieces together. But it was a kind of long process.
Yeah, Marla and I just both wish that we could play viola and or cello, and we can't. So yeah, we're like,
I failed violin
recruit?
Class.
I took viola in college, and it like as a private lesson, just real quick, but it didn't go that well. So I'm like,
what is it about this? What is it about that sound, that stringed instrument sound, when matched to sort of indie rock? What is that sound that attracts you guys?
For me, it's just the warmth of the instruments. It's so nice to play a song and not count on a guitar to do the lead part. You know, give that to a string player, viola. It's just darker, richer, warmer for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. I think the viola, for Sarah and I, a lot of the lyrics or the vocal line mm-hmm. can sometimes be echoed with the viola. And so we have a kind of a cool thing going there. We started playing together, I guess, probably 3 or 4 years ago now. But we just kind of, it was just sort of a natural thing that happened. And I think it's we got a cool thing going right there.
when you know, you're putting together different genres of music to create something new, what inspires you? What are you guys listening to? What are other bands that our listeners back at WGN, you know, listening at WGN Radio Live now mm-hmm. would have a sort of base or a jumping off point to understand this music?
Whew, that's Ooh. A loaded question. Yeah. We listen to a lot of music. We've been obsessed lately with Gregory Alan Isakoff. He's super amazing. Samantha Crane is really amazing. we've been listening to a lot of Wild Bell, which they're from Chicago, but they mm-hmm. don't sound like us really. But we have been listening to a lot of them.
I really like the string work in Hey Rosetta, Lost in the Trees. Mm-hmm. So. Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah, we've got a whole list of music. We're kind of music junkies. We go to a lot of the Chicago venues. We're probably, if we're not playing a show, we're at a show.
Really?
Yeah.
That's good to know. I mean, as a musician, you kind of have to do that, right? I mean, it's not, you can't just play your own music and go study in your house. You have to get out there, right?
Yeah, you got to get out and listen to what people are doing.
Marlon Aguilar and Corey Simonson are joined by Jacob Fawcett, Sarah Cornish, and Rachel Schult. They are the band Max the Fox. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to sound check, and we're going to hear some live music here in studio on the download. So stay with us. All right. It's the download here on WGN Radio. Monday night, we got live music in studio from Chicago band Max the Fox, orchestral folk pop sounds. We're ready for them. What are we going to hear here, guys?
We're going to play Come Around.
Come Around? All right, the song Come Around here live in the WGN Allstate Showcase Studio here on Michigan Avenue. Take it away, guys. Thank you. All right, live in studio, Max DeFox here on the download here in the Allstate Showcase Studio on Michigan Avenue. A great track, Come Around, that was the name of the track?
Yes,
all right. Come on up to the table, whoever would like to talk here for the band. Max DeFox is going to be at the Tonic Room Saturday night in Lincoln Park, 2447 North Halsted Street. The band that we just heard, Corey Simonson, Jacob Fawcett, Sarah Cornish, Rachel Schultz, and Marlon Aguilar. And we talked a little bit about, you know, the music sort of being rock and roll with strings, and you can hear it there.
Yeah.
You know, it's great. I mean, it seems like it'd be a no-brainer to have strings involved. Why don't more people involve the cello and the viola and other classical music instruments in rock and roll?
The first time that I tried to play with strings, I had a hard time playing with string players that were used to sheet music. So, you know, they would come in and try and play some tunes with me and say, "Do you have the charts?" And I'd be like, "I don't know what you're talking about." I play these four chords and, you know, just figure, you know, can you figure it out?
Right.
And this is what was great when we met Sarah. I gave her no direction. I just said, "These are the songs I have kind of working on right now."
And she Sarah sits down here at the Sarah Cornish. She was on viola on that track. That was great. Talk about your relationship with the viola. I mean, was it something that you started with in classical music?
I did. I have been playing since I was 9 years old. I am 26. I don't even know how old I am. But yeah, I knew immediately that I wanted to play an instrument when they first introduced it into elementary school, and I wanted to play viola because it was different, and I thought it would be cool, and it would make me cool, even though being an orchestra dork is not super cool,
but
it was a blast.
But I'm fascinated by the transition from being an orchestral, I guess, nerd to a rock and roll nerd. I mean, at what point did you say, "This is something that I want to pursue and play music with this instrument in this genre"?
Well, I've always been interested in, I guess, trying to play more alternative styles with my viola. I mean, in the classical world, there aren't very many outlets to learn that type of music. Even improv is pretty rare. I think it's picking up more now these days, but I mean, there was only, like, when I went to school for music, there was only one class for improvisation, and
the rest was just for, like you mentioned, charts and
real formal structure.
Pretty much.
Is it hard for you to break out with that training being so formal? Is it hard to break out and play and like Marlon said, like, "Hey, this is what I'm just G to D, man. Figure it out.
It was very intimidating, but I really wanted to do it. I wanted to challenge myself because I have difficulty memorizing sheet music as it is. So I was like, "Well, let's try not having sheet music and making it parts. See how that goes." And it went really well.
It worked out.
Corey, you mentioned that it took a couple of sort of, you know, tries to get the right mix in this band. You know, talk about that content, Marlon. You might have brought that up just about trying to is viola the right choice? Is cello the right choice? Is this the right, can this player, what are the challenges of trying to bring strings into a pop band?
Well, we knew right away that we wanted viola. Marlon and I wrote some our songs separately on the first album, and then on the second album, well, I should finish with that, the debut album, we had Sarah kind of fill in on our songs, and then the second album was more collaborative. So the three of us were already kind of writing songs together, and then Sarah was working at a string shop, and she was like, "Oh, my friend Rachel plays cello." So we were like, "Okay, let's call her right now and tell her to come over." And we literally took Sarah's phone from her and was like, "Okay, let's call her right now." And she was only
come over to her house.
She lived like a mile from my house. I was living in Oak Park at the time, and Rachel was right down the street. So we had her come over at the very next band practice, and so it all just kind of happened. That happened sort of organically, I guess. And we love the strings, and then we found Jacob. Marlon's he records also. He's a recording engineer, so. He knew Jacob through a previous recording project that he had done. So the band just kind of all came together for us.
Well, the band is Max the Fox. It's album, the new album is called From the Deer Forest. It's just out this March. They're going to be playing at the Tonic Room on Saturday night, Lincoln Park, 2447 North Halsted Street. We're going to take a break for the news. When we return, some more live music here?
Yes.
Yeah. All right. Studio set list 435. We'll figure it out.
Nice.
That's next. It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. It's Monday, so there's live music in studio in the Allstate Showcase Studio here on Michigan Avenue. The crowd is hanging off the rafters out here, the scaffolding. It's not really rafters, it's scaffolding. Max the Fox is in studio with me. The orchestral folk pop music here from Chicago-based Max the Fox. They're playing at the Tonic Room. Coming up on Saturday night in Lincoln Park, 2447 North Halsted. They're live in studio. What are we going to hear now?
All right, this next one is called All in Time.
All in Time, Max the Fox, live here on 720 WGN. Take a guess.
All right. One, two, three. The one that you went for is not the one that you're meant for. But you figure it out. You'll figure it out. It's all in time, all in time. Or you moved to the west coast, all the way from the east coast. And pulls you around, he pulls you around. All the time, all the time. It's the time you have wasted for your own goals. It's the heart that one sees.
The time you have. one that you're meant for. But you'll figure it out, you'll figure it out. All in time, all in time, all in time, all in time.
Yeah! There we go, Max the Fox, live in studio. There we go. They get the people outside. I think the scaffolding's got the... You can hear the construction. You can't hear the clapping. We're live in the Allstate Showcase studio here on Michigan Avenue. Max the Fox, the local Chicago folk pop orchestral music, playing at the Tonic Room on Saturday night, 2447 North Halsted. Marlon Aguilar joins me. That song. Now, talk about the new record. Talk about the stuff you put out in March and the difference. Because you guys have only been around probably, what, 4 years or so?
Yeah, 4 years.
So as you've jumped, you've done two albums now. Uh-huh. What's the evolution like for a band like yours? I mean, how is the music on the new record different than the last?
Well, like Corey said earlier, the first record started with Corey and I were just playing open mics together. We'd go out and I'd play a few of my tunes. She'd play, you know, her tunes. I'd back her up on some stuff. But they were very much two different song ideas and just performed. And the second album, we really took the approach of writing the songs together as a band mm-hmm. in band practice, or bringing ideas to the group, and then everyone brings in their input. So everyone was way more involved in the...
And how does that play out in the music? When you hear the music, the effect that everyone was collaborative, what has changed in the Max the Fox sound?
I think it opened up the range of what the songs, I guess, hit.
Yeah, I think when I write a song now, I think of what can Rachel's part be and what can Sarah's part be, and like...
You learn to leave more room.
There's going
to
be a... Jacob's going to have a drum solo right here. Play what you feel, man. Jacob's up at the table now, too. But, yeah, I think we've been writing the songs, you know, at band practice. It's much more collaborative. We talk. There's three girls in the band.
It's a lot
so
of meetings.
A lot of talking.
There's
a lot of meetings.
A lot of meetings.
We talk about our feelings.
Sure, sure.
You know, how do we reviews. Feel about the song?
There's spreadsheets involved. It's real serious.
There's coffee breaks.
Yeah.
So many. We actually prefer to practice just for the breaks.
Just for the breaks.
You know, we practice Wednesday night. It's a good...
It's a great night to practice.
It is.
Just
it's
once a week.
Break,
I don't like it. It's got to be more. Rachel, let me bring you in on this. You're playing sure. cello on that track.
Uh-huh.
Talk about your involvement in the band, because you were on the other side of that phone call to join the band. But you come from I would assume, playing cello. You come from a classical music background. Talk mm-hmm. about your transition into a folk rock band.
That phone call was extremely entertaining because I had Sarah, Marlon, and Corey on speakerphone, and I just hear this just jumble of, "You're going to join our band!" And I'm like, what are you even talking about? You know. So, and I was playing with another band at that time because, like you said, my background, I was classical performance major. For Sarah and me in that world, I think she made a good point that it was very much, especially if you're performance major, because you don't have that degree in music education, is you're told, okay, so you're going to play in an orchestra, you're going to have a studio,
right.
all of these students, and maybe you'll do some gigs and life will be happy and
right.
jolly and all that. For me, that wasn't exactly the route I wanted to do. So I got more involved in improvisation and studying not only a little jazz improvisation, but a little contemporary, you just call free improvisation, which you just play right on the spot and hope it goes well. So I was playing with another band at that time when I had these three goofballs call me. and I said, yeah, sure. That
yeah,
sounds,
it sounds good.
Yeah, it sounds good. I'll
drop
that.
Dropped off a CD the very same day, I think.
Yes, you did. You did. You
did. Listen to this. Tell me what you want to add.
Hey, Jacob, jump on the... I have a question for the drummer in the band. Does your approach to the music... And I would assume you don't have as much of a if at all, a classical background. You come from a rock and roll background. Does it change the way that you do percussions when you're dealing with stringed instruments?
Well, actually, like getting back to like an earlier question you had, like I feel like I kind of bridged the gap because I'm a music school dropout.
Okay.
So, like, I know where they're coming from as far as music school background, and I know what it's like not to be in music school. I've been playing in different bands around Chicago for 10 years now, and I think that it works. Like, whatever we're doing just works. I like to do as minimal as possible, because my whole style is just based on me not messing up.
Spoken like a true drummer. Well, that's Jacob Fawcett, Corey Simonson, Sarah Cornish, Rachel Schultz, and Marlon Aguilar make up the band Max the Fox. They're playing at the Tonic Room, 2447 North Halsted Street on Saturday. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back. You guys got one more in you?
Yeah, we got one more.
All right, we'll finish it out here tonight on The Download. Stay with us. It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman in studio, in the Allstate Showcase studio here on Michigan Avenue. We've got Max the Fox, local band, orchestral folk pop, rock and roll. They've been performing live all hour in our sort of inaugural 10 o'clock hour here. We still haven't come up with a name, but we will by next week. Max the Fox is playing at the Tonic Room Saturday night in Lincoln Park, 2447 North Halsted. We're going to get one more song out of him. What are we going to hear here, guys?
Next up is Rhodes.
Rhodes. Is that right? Rhodes?
Rhodes, yep. You got it.
That you drive on. Okay, Rhodes, here live in studio. Take it away.
Thank you.
Yeah! All right. Give it up for Max DeFox live in our WGN Showcase studio. They have a show at the Tonic Room coming up here on Saturday night, 2447 North Halsted Street. Their new album's out called From the Deer Forest. You can find them, Max DeFox, M-A-K-S, The Fox. The quintet is Corey Simonson, Jacob Fawcett, Sarah Cornish, Rachel Schultz, and Marlon Aguilar. I want to thank all of you for being in studio tonight. And thank you for being here for the full hour. I mean, this is a new thing for us, and we appreciate you guys were the first band, so thank you.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
And have a great show on Saturday night, and we'll take care.
Thank you.
That's going to do it tonight for The Download. Exciting night. Thanks to Max DeFox again, and thanks to Bob Ferguson. What a tremendous job setting this band up and being able to pull this off. I mean, there's so many different pieces. It's unbelievable to watch this talk studio be transformed into a music studio before our eyes, and Bob has everything to do with that. So thanks, Bob Ferguson. Patty Vasquez up next with Pretty Late with Patty Vasquez.